Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. In this episode, we're going to talk about Disney's new streaming efforts, how our analysts would spend a $3,000 tax refund, and some of the stocks that we think could be the next Dell or Netflix. So on the last episode of Stock Club, we talked about Apple TV Plus, and Rory, you weren't very impressed by Apple's efforts. In the meantime, Disney has unveiled their own streaming service, inventively called Disney Plus. Are you more impressed by Disney's effort, Rory?
Well, I think everyone is. And if I just like, I think when I was watched the Disney Plus presentation, all I could kind of think was to compare it to Apple's and how much of a difference there was. You know, Apple wheeled out all these celebrities, basically told us very little about the product in terms of like what would be available when it launched, what price it would be, even when it was going to actually come out. It's actually even kind of silly that they had an event first. You know, I mean, they could have done that with a coming soon tweet.
Just coming probably, soon, yeah.
Yeah, that would have been way more appropriate than having an entire event based around it. And then like compare that to what Disney did. They had a few celebrities, kind of the top actors from the Marvel Universe, but they actually showed us the platform. Like, you actually got to see how it would work. They had clips from upcoming hit movies on it. They told us how much it would cost, what part of the catalogue would be included, how much they were going to spend on it, how many subscribers they expected, when they expect to be profitable. Like, they basically told us everything.
Yeah.
Even the fact that they might bundle it with ESPN Plus and Hulu. And all I could kind of imagine watching it was like, there must be some Apple executives watching this going, we should have bought Disney.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
Really, if you think about it, like, Disney Plus is exactly what they want from Apple Plus.
Yeah.
You know, it is a streaming service that's family friendly. It has premium content. It's got a huge amount of intellectual property that has proven time and time again to attract audiences. Can you imagine like Apple unveiling their next phone 2 years down the line, and in order to show how great their new screen is, they'd be able to take, you know, a clip from the next Marvel film or the next Star Wars film or the next Avatar film, which Disney owns now, and show it like live in the event. Like, isn't that just so Apple?
Yes.
And I'd say they're probably kicking themselves now.
Speaking of premium content there, Rory, just so we're clear of all the things that Disney will be adding to this, they'll have everything from the Disney brand itself, from Marvel, from Pixar, from Star Wars, from National Geographic. And they'll have all the programming they also got from the Fox acquisition too. So that's 30 seasons of The Simpsons will be on Disney Plus straight away. There's other things like classic movies like The Sound of Music and Malcolm in the Middle as well, which I always loved.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've just got a huge amount of stuff. Even like the day one stuff they're releasing is already enough for me to think it's a no-brainer for most households in America.
Yeah,
$7 a month?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You pay twice that easily.
Yeah.
Especially if you have kids, because the problem Netflix has is that they have to keep generating new content over and over and over again. And they've seen a problem where people actually subscribe to Netflix, watch what they want, and then cancel the subscription until the next season of something that they want comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Disney doesn't have that problem because kids will watch the same thing over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And they just have all that content right away available. So when Disney said they're only going to spend, you know, $2 billion a year in content generation in the next few years, they don't have to spend that much. They're spending billions on their big blockbuster movies, which will obviously go down into the service as they become available.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think it's just a no-brainer. And I doubt that $7 per month fee is going to remain that way for very long.
Well, you mentioned Netflix there, and you know, the $7 a month, it's 45% cheaper than Netflix's standard price. Emmett, as a Netflix shareholder, would you be worried about this, or would it fit in with many households as part of a Netflix subscription, do you think?
I think they're very complementary products, James. Now, time will prove if people want one or the other.
Yeah.
I think they complement each other very well for the reasons that Rory explained. My children would happily consume Disney content you know, nonstop. And Netflix, you have to dig a little deeper. And I think their content, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, is a little more orientated for people at our age. And really the way I see it going is that houses will stack up a couple of subscriptions, and for those homes that haven't yet cut the cord, it's gone. You know, it's really now down to a couple of subscription services.
That'll eventually add up to the price of a cable bill.
Yeah, well, you'd hope not. I mean, even if it does, you're getting such better content. But do you think you could just add the valuation of Netflix onto Disney now? If they have like a, if they get, end up getting 90 million subscribers in the next few years, Netflix is valued at what, 150 billion? Is that like, could you add another billion onto Disney's valuation?
No, I don't know.
I'm not sure if valuation math works like that, but perhaps.
Well, like, imagine they had 100 million subscribers and they up the price to what Netflix is charging. Yeah. That's an extra 10 billion a year in revenue.
Yeah.
So that's a huge add to the business.
Absolutely.
Investors were definitely happy about Disney's announcement. The stock jumped at the time of recording. Now it's up more than 13% since the announcement. And, you know, Disney shares had really kind of been in the doldrums the last few years. So it was nice to see Disney get a bit of a boost like that.
What? It's amazing. A company valued at about $250 billion to jump 12%. It's just unbelievable. I could not believe, you know, the effect that this new Disney Plus had on the valuation of the business. And you're right, Rory, we might see that over the years, as they land grab around the world, that they've got a whole new catalyst that we just, at this moment in time, might even make Disney look like good value today.
Yeah, well, I mean, like the thing about Disney as well is it's not just about the money generated by movies. It never has been. It's all about getting people into that ecosystem where the kids love the characters, they love the films, then they want to go to Disney World, they want to go on the cruises, they want to buy the games, they want to buy the toys. It's a whole distribution pipeline of content. So just the fact that they're exposing more people to this in a cheap way is always going to be good for the business going forward.
And as a parent, you can subscribe to Disney Plus and you can safely say to your kids, watch whatever you want, which is just great.
Yeah.
And I know as a parent, you with Netflix or with alternatives, and even despite parental controls, you still have a caution there that there are shows that you'd prefer they didn't see.
Mm. Yep. So moving on then, and I think this podcast is fast becoming just a discussion about IPOs. This week, or well, last week I should say, Uber released their S1 in preparation of their IPO. And this is probably one of the most anticipated IPOs of the year. Rory, what is the S1 though, just for anyone who doesn't know? What does the S1 mean?
The S1 is just the very first kind of offering document that a company puts forward. It kind of details, the first version of it is kind of a bit loose on what kind of amount of shares they're offering and how much it's going to be offering them on. But it kind of gives you the first full audited copy of their financials. It gives you a good breakdown of what management thinks. It's kind of like their first annual report, really.
Okay.
And public investors in on what's going on in the business.
So we can see their health, kind of, and how are Uber looking?
Uber is a very tough one to judge. It's a giant document, a couple of hundred pages. Some notes from it, the CEO wrote a letter, as they usually do, talking about it, and this was one quote that I grabbed, which I thought was important. He said, "When I joined Uber as CEO, many people asked me why I would leave the stability of my previous job for one that was anything but. My answer was simple. Uber is a once-in-a-generation company and the opportunity ahead is enormous." I think I kind of agree with him on that.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's kind of redefined the whole way we think about transport in a lot of ways.
Yeah, completely. And like we talked about this a while ago in terms of what IPOs we were most excited about. And Emmett, you said Airbnb, and I was going to, I kind of agreed with you on that, but Uber was definitely my second one because I really do think they are the most disruptive company in the world at the moment.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of how the business is going, it's not that great.
Okay.
They lost $3.3 billion in operations last year. So that's excluding the money that they made from selling parts of their Southeast Asia business and their Russia business. They had a metric in there which I thought was a bit fuzzy. It's their monthly active users number,
okay,
which they have at the moment at 91 million, which is a really annoying metric because they talk about it all the time. They use it as a judge of how well they're performing. But they have combined their core ride-hailing business with their food delivery business in that number.
Uber Eats, yeah.
Which basically makes that metric useless because, like, if you're gonna pay for like a 5 mile journey, you're gonna pay for someone to take you from point A to point B. You're gonna pay an awful lot more than if you're gonna get someone to pick you up some food 5 miles away and drop it to you.
Yeah.
So that metric is just kind of wacky, and I don't really know why they decided to combine them like that.
So they're not easily comparable. Like, you know, a taxi ride isn't the same as a delivery charge.
Yeah, I mean, for a $10 taxi ride, you're going to pay, a $2 delivery charge. They're just the totally different numbers, totally different businesses.
Yeah.
Some other thing, interesting notes, the growth has definitely slowed. Okay. They had doubled their revenues last year. It's up about 40% this year.
Okay.
Now, obviously, that's just the law of big numbers is coming into effect there. But they've also lost market share. According to Second Measure Incorporated, which analyzes credit card transactions, Uber had 78% market share 2 years ago. That's down to 67% at the moment. It's one of those things with new IPOs, you always have to be wondering, why are they going public now? Like, what is the purpose of them going public now? And a lot of the times, or maybe that's a bit unfair to say a lot of the times, but sometimes it's because the early investors look at the business, they look at how the business model is going right now, and they see the end of the growth story.
Okay.
And that could be what's happening here.
So it's kind of putting it public to get that little bit of an extra cash injection.
Well, to get out. They want want a liquidity event. Like, I mean, look at what happened with Blue Apron.
Snap.
Snap. Blue Apron in particular, that was just a disaster.
Yeah.
Clearly saw the business model was failing and decided to get out before that happened. Uber's a weird one. So you could say growth is slowing. The rideshare business has basically been flat for the last few quarters. But at the same time, as they point out in the S1, they've only penetrated 1% of the market as they see it.
As they see it, yeah. Yeah. So that was some of the recent news stories from the past 2 weeks. Moving on then, we usually do our company we never talk about segment here. But as many of our American listeners know, Monday was tax deadline day in the US. Here at My Wall Street, we've been doing a bit of research on the topic over the past few days, and in particular, tax refunds, which I'm sure is everyone's favourite part of tax season. According to the IRS, the average tax refund for a US citizen has been roughly $3,000 per year for the past 10 years. In an article you can read exclusively in the My Wall Street app right now, we've calculated how much you would have made if you'd simply invested that sum into Apple, Amazon and Netflix over the past 10 years. But instead of the usual segment here, Evan and Rory, I want to ask you guys, if you'd got $3,000 as a tax refund right now, how would you be spending it? Emmett.
Well, simply, I'd be investing it, James, as I'm sure. Predictable answer number one.
I didn't tell you to say that.
No. There's a sequence in which someone should use a windfall like that. And very first, I think most financial advisors would advise us to retire short-term high-interest debt.
Yeah.
So if I came into 3,000 bucks and I had some credit card debt sitting out there, the first thing I'd do would be to pay that down.
Yeah.
So then let me go two routes on my answer. The first is if I was a brand new investor and had $3,000, I'd probably take that money and divide it equally amongst six companies.
Okay.
Now, I know we have a question coming at us from one of our listeners about what's the next Netflix, and I'm going to attempt to answer that with lots of caveats and T's and C's. And I think when we go there, I'll describe some of those companies. But the first thing I do is I take that 3,000 bucks and I'd personally put 506 different companies.
Okay.
That's if I was a brand new investor. If I was a little more mature, I had an existing portfolio, I would do what I've done for the last 20 years, which is add some cash to my favorites and maybe open one or two new positions.
Yeah. Rory?
I'm gonna buy myself something first.
Okay.
I'm gonna buy myself a new phone.
Fair enough.
my current phone is literally on its last legs. So I'd buy myself a new phone, new Apple iPhone.
So how much do you have left then?
So let's just imagine I've $2,000 left. I'd open up a new position in a company that I really like, which at the moment I'm gonna say is Eventbrite.
Okay.
And I'd add to one of my favorites, which at the moment is Viva Systems.
Viva Systems. And is there any reason why you'd add now, just for the windfall, or
why would I add now?
Yeah.
Reinvest money in your favourite companies is always a good plan to growing your personal wealth.
Sounds good. So apart from that tax refund article in the My Wall Street app, there's plenty of new stuff too. We added a new stock 2 weeks ago. Emmett, it's one of your favourites.
It is, and I invested in it.
So you can check that out in the app now. Rory, you've also added a new expert opinion piece, which is about IPOs, I believe.
Yeah, it's basically a longer version of what I just talked about there.
Hot topic at the minute. So you can check out all of that stuff in the My Wall Street app right now. Right, we're moving on to one of the favourite sections of the podcast, which is Jargon Busters. So every 2 weeks, you, the listeners, send in questions that you'd like either Emmett or Rory to bust. So these can be questions about investing or maybe even companies in particular. The first question we have here comes in from one of our followers, Brendan Rogers, on Twitter. He asked about renewable energy companies. So he's kind of looking, is there any companies that are taking advantage of the transfer to renewable energy, or is it even a segment worth diversifying into? So I suppose the obvious answer is Tesla at the moment, but outside of Tesla.
In terms of investing in renewable energy?
Yeah,
companies.
Or even the segment or the industry in general.
Yeah, so there's a couple of industries in the world of investing that I think you really should avoid unless you have some sort of industry knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, there's people who get paid an awful lot of money in Goldman Sachs just to focus on the banking sector, just to focus on the pharmaceutical sector, and just to focus on the energy sector. Those are three in particular that I can kind of off the top of my head, where unless you have some sort of industry knowledge that no one else does, you're probably going to find yourself lost at sea there, because it's very hard to pinpoint when the next great in renewable energy is going to come out.
Yeah.
You know, we looked for a while. There's an ETF a few years ago called TAN, which was all the solar companies, which 5 years ago, solar power was the big hot topic in terms of stock investing. And if you look how that's performed over the last few years, you can see that it's not always as easy as going, oh, there's a trend, we should invest in that.
Yeah, so it's maybe an industry that the ordinary kind of investor should stay away from unless they've kind of got some insight.
Yeah, because it's just not as it's not as straightforward as investing in, say, a software company or a retail company. There's a huge amount of government regulation involved. You need to know a bit about commodities and commodity pricing and things like that. So unless you have a kind of inside track on something, or unless you're willing to spend an awful lot of time researching it, which, you know, if that's what you want to do, start doing that. But I wouldn't go in blind just thinking you can invest in it the same way you can invest in kind of a retail company.
Okay.
I think it's the perpetual question. I remember 25 years ago looking for the next best green energy investment. It will always be there. And although the obvious answer is Tesla, I think it is also the best choice for an investor at the moment.
Yeah.
I remember, I think around 1998, buying shares in Ballard Power. I bought shares in Solar... something or another. I had a whole stack of investments in, let's just call it the green agenda. And the complexities that existed then are still at play today, as explained by Rory. And it's a very diffuse area and very difficult to try and say, yeah, that is the one to go for. And even the ETFs, Rory and I spent some time looking for good green and renewable ETFs. And without labouring it, none apparently jumped out at us.
Okay. That's very clear. Thanks for that. So thanks for the question, Brendan. The next question we have here is from Thomas Noonan. That was sent in through email. And he asked what our thoughts are on Momo, a Chinese social media company.
I had a look at them last night. I saw the... Thank you for sending through the question. And my best answer right now is leave it with us. Because China is so complex. And add the mores of dating in China and the way people interact, romantically, I have to say it's just a little bit outside my circle of competence at the moment.
Yeah, it'd be well outside my circle. Yeah. I mean, like, even trying to value things like Facebook and Snapchat and Twitter in the Western world, very hard.
It is.
If you try and then transpose that to a totally different culture with a totally different way of doing things, I mean, it's kind of like, even if we looked into it, would there be value in our assertions,
I noticed it was liked by David Gardner and the team over at the Motley Fool in their Rule Breakers service. And for me, that carries a lot of weight. Doesn't necessarily mean it's my opinion, but I can tell you, just seeing that they recommended it for me would feel that it's an amber to green light, out of the blocks, but personally I don't understand the business, and Motley Fool Rule Breakers I'm sure do a very good job of analysing it.
There's that company YY we had a look at.
Yeah. We sure did.
Give us a quick description of what YY is.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like speed dating, but it's for karaoke, really. You just hop on in there and, or no, what's that thing, roulette? Is it a dating roulette? And it kind of
chat roulette,
thank you. Chat roulette, but with music.
Well, if I had $3,000 now, I know where it would be going.
I'm sure YY, by the way, do other things. But, yeah. You know, certainly if you're going to be known for something, what better than Sing Roulette?
Next question we have in is from Colin Morn, through email as well. And he was asking about Baozun. So recently they offered $225 million in senior convertible notes. So he was wondering, what does it mean by senior convertible notes?
Yes. So when a company wants to raise money, there's kind of two ways they can go about it. They can raise debt or they can raise equity.
Yeah.
And a senior convertible note is kind of a mixture of both. So the note part of it is that they've issued debt to someone. Someone's given them money for debt, which they'll pay a coupon on. The convertible part is that at a certain price point, the debtor can basically convert his debt to stocks.
Okay.
To equity.
Yeah.
So it's a way for debtors to kind of put in some money into the business and potentially gain some upside if the company performs really well.
Yeah.
So Colin then just added as well there, I see the question, did that have anything to do with the 6% drop? Yeah, probably, because that was potential equity added.
Okay.
So the shareholder dilution was occurring there if the notes get converted.
Okay. Okay, that's pretty clear. And then the last question we have here was from Tommy John on email as well. And he asked you, Emmett, so on the podcast 2 weeks ago, Emmett, you talked about your investment in Dell and how you'd kind of used Dell as an archetype for your investment in Netflix then a few years later, and which was a very successful investment for you. So he asked, we have a section in our My Wall Street app called Star Stocks, and he kind of was wondering, were these Star Stocks kind of the next Dell or the next Netflix as you saw it? And then, you know, do you have any specific stocks you think might be the next Netflix?
Yeah, what's the next Dell, Emmett?
Hewlett Packard.
Tell us.
Thanks, James. That story completely resonated with a huge number of our listeners, because turning $1,000 into $1.6 million in the space of 10 years is a super normal event in most people's financial lives. And it's also a super normal event in an investing life. It takes a huge amount of luck, and it takes a great amount of judgment. And because of that story, the very question that Tommy John sent in, I had heard from other channels. So it almost, that question came at me like an orchestra after the podcast, and I had to think a little bit about it before this podcast and kind of write up a note on it, which I sent to some friends of my Wall Street. So I guess the first thing I'd say is that, you know, back when I looked for the next Netflix, which was something like 15 or 16 years ago, there was a hot kind of incubation ground for businesses that were in the valuation range of between kind of 200, 500 million market cap.
Yeah.
And a lot of water has gone under the bridge since then. And a $200 million company now is more like a $2 billion company if you talk about it in equivalent terms.
Yeah.
So one of the things I said during the week to the people I was speaking with was that like $2 billion is the new $200 million. And what I mean by that is looking for great investments that have a market cap of $200 million today is not actually prudent. I think that those businesses are too small to make any reliable call. And then the next thing I would say is, in looking for the next Dell, or indeed the next Netflix or the next great stock, you can look, but you must diversify and buy as many businesses that you believe have a good chance as possible.
Yeah.
And like any portfolio manager, whether it's a venture capitalist or whether it's Warren Buffett or whether it's Peter Lynch or whether it's the three of us here, acknowledges that with the best of judgment, a few of the businesses you invest in are going to turn out to be dogs, and a few will turn out to kind of match or slightly beat the market, and then some will actually end up hopefully being the next Netflix. And that's the portfolio approach that we advocate here and that we espouse, and that we aspire for every one of our members and customers to work towards. So the short answer is that we don't put a stock into My Wall Street without it being very well vetted by the three of us here, plus others downstairs. And we put a lot of thought into each one. And we, as our scoreboard shows, we don't always get it right, but we get it right more often than not, which is great. So I have a short list of stocks that I personally like at the moment. And what I would say is I wouldn't dare say any of them are going to be the next Netflix. But what I would say is they have attributes that I believe have them positioned to grow beyond the returns of the market in the 5 to 10 years ahead.
And these are the attributes you talk about quite often, I imagine. So like founder-led companies.
Exactly. Yeah,
things like that.
Exactly. Customer evangelists and a future relevant product. And there's a whole bunch of attributes, which I'm pretty sure we have an explainer on our website.
Yeah. And well, also in the Learn app, I think we go through it quite comprehensively.
Oh, absolutely. And, absolutely.
Like, it's probably important to note that just because a company has some of these attributes doesn't necessarily make it a great investment either. It's just it's a good marker or a good indicator to look deeper.
So we might again come at that another time, but we have historically run 6 qualitative and 6 quantitative viewpoints on stocks. And it doesn't mean that every stock that looks exactly like Dell on the 1st of 1990 today will actually turn out to be a great investment.
Yeah.
That might not be the case. So it's not a mutually exclusive club that these companies all have these attributes. And the next thing I'll say before I dive in is that I might be wrong. I have 13 companies here that I particularly like, and as I said to my friends during the week, I have a short list of the 13, which I'll also call out.
Yeah.
But none may turn out to be even close to the next Netflix. So it is truly a rare event to invest in Dell. And when I happened across that Dell observation, if you like, in my early 20s, it was cherry-picked, of course. I probably Googled, or whatever Google was at the time, what was the best investment of the last 10 years. And I think my eyes popped out when I saw, you know, the returns that the market could actually bring an ordinary person like me. So the stocks that I believe look really good for a retail investor, that's us, today. And I'm not saying they're cheap, but I think they're just wonderful businesses.
Yeah.
Are as follows. And I own shares in all but 2 of them. So Shopify, iRobot, The Trade Desk, Houzoo, Viva, Twilio. Twilio? Thanks, Rory. Arista, Atlassian, Teladoc, Baozun, Tesla, Stitch Fix, and Duluth. So they are 13 companies in which I have invested, with the exception of The Trade Desk, regrettably, and Houzoo, regrettably as well. But so that's 13, and that's still a lot to get your head and wallet around. And I am not advising, suggesting, or trying to tip our listeners towards running out and getting their savings, smashing their piggy bank and distributing amongst those 13 businesses. If I was to further have that list, there are ones that I prefer. And I'm a big fan of Shopify, iRobot, Viva, Arista, Atlassian, and Tesla.
Yeah.
And I have shares in all 6 of those businesses.
Yeah.
So I am not saying that one of those 6, or indeed 13 before it, stocks are the next Netflix. What I am saying is I'm invested in the ones I called out, and I will be sticking with them through thick and thin. And I happen to believe that 1, 2, 3, 4 of them will do inordinately well.
Yeah.
I just don't know which 1, 2, or 3 will do inordinately well.
Yeah.
I could keep going and tell you what my absolute favorite is, but that's actually an exercise in futility, because we sit down as a team every month, we pick our stock of the month, and unbiased, we debate them, as you well know, James, and we say, if we had only $1,000 on our lap now and there was a gun to our head to invest in only one company, which one would we choose? And that process drives us with stock of the month.
Yeah.
And by me kind of saying what my absolute favorite is at the moment, it just doesn't, it's not useful.
Yeah, that was very helpful. I think it is important to kind of see, you know, the Dells and the Netflix of the world as a good analogy and a good example. But, you know, you can obviously never, use it, history never repeats itself exactly. You know, the next company that comes out like that, you can't, it's hard to find it. And moving on from those companies you like then to our elevator pitch. So at the minute in the My Wall Street app, as you mentioned, Emmett, there are 101 stocks live. And out of these, there are 20 that are in the red since we've recommended them, which is a pretty good return by all means, I have to say. So my elevator pitch for you guys this week is, which of the stocks that are currently in the red in the My Wall Street app do you like most at the minute and why? So 60 seconds. Emmett, you talked for a long time there, so Rory, I'll let you go first.
Okay. The company, there's a couple of companies I like that are in the red at the moment. I've mentioned Eventbrite earlier there, but the one I'm actually going to pick this time is called ShotSpotter.
Yeah.
ShotSpotter is a leader in gunshot detection technology, allowing law enforcement to pinpoint where a gunshot comes from in a matter of seconds and can alert them to what kind of weapons are being used and if there's multiple shooters, which is vital for protecting first responders. They launched it in a district in Chicago about 2-3 years ago. They've seen a 50% reduction in gun crime since then. Milwaukee last year announced that it had a 20% reduction in gun crime since launching with the service. And I think just it's a very small company at the moment, $500 million company. And I just think if you use your imagination, you can easily see how this business will grow. Think of all the scenarios in which you want to protect people or animals from the danger of gunfire. So there's a big opportunity in college campuses, major corporate campuses, school districts, sadly, and even national parks like the ones in Africa, which are being plagued by poachers. So they're creeping towards profitability. They expect to be GAAP profitable this year on revenues of about 45 to 47 million. And that would put them about 12 times sales at the current valuation, which for a business with high retention, it seems like a good deal to me.
Okay, very good. ShotSpotter. Emmett, what company do you want to go with?
So as Rory said that, I realised we need to be a little more aligned because I also chose ShotSpotter. And rather than...
Well, that's a good endorsement.
It actually is. And I think some of our listeners will value the viewpoint that I was about to give because without any bias, evidently, I walked in and Rory and I would usually at least talk on the way up the stairs to the studio. And on this instance, we had a tip. So I've also chosen ShotSpotter. And I think it's a wonderful company. I think it's underloved, unwatched. They have a monopoly in the area in which they operate, and they have added new colleges, new cities, and dozens of new net square miles of coverage with their technology. And just last quarter made just about $9.2 million. So why I like ShotSpotter as well is that they are unwatched by analysts on Wall Street. They have a monopolistic hold on a technology that, frankly, the world needs and North America particularly needs. They are doing something good. They're doing it well. Their technology works. And all I can say is next time I'll pick something different. But I think it's a nice endorsement to have two picks that are the same.
Yeah, no, I'm actually a shareholder in ShotSpotter too.
Hey, so am I actually.
Company. Yeah, so.
And are you, Rory?
No, but I think I will be soon.
You found ShotSpotter, actually.
Yeah. Like ShotSpotter, so two 1 minute endorsements of ShotSpotter there for our elevator pitch, which is pretty good. So that's about it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget, as I mentioned already, there's tons of exclusive new investing content in the My Wall Street app at the minute, including the new stock, the expert opinion piece, and the tax refunds article I mentioned earlier. So please make sure to check all of that out now. If you have anything that you would like us to discuss or some jargon for us to bust on the next episode, please get in touch with us on Twitter at MyWallStreet or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd really appreciate a review on iTunes or whatever podcast player you listen to us on. It helps us get to a wider audience. From the three of us here today, see you in 2 weeks and thanks for listening.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.